Welcome to the Beacon broadcast from Beacon Baptist Church in Burlington, North Carolina, featuring expositional Bible teaching by Pastor Greg Barkman. If you'd like to correspond with the Beacon broadcast, or if you wish to support this radio ministry, write to the Beacon broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina, 27201, or find us on the web at beaconbaptist.com. BeaconBaptist.com. The Beacon broadcast is supported in part by the gifts of faithful listeners. Now, with today's message from God's Word, here is Greg Barkman.
Amazing grace.
I remember hearing a song many years ago that said, "I'm guided by the unseen hand." And that came back to my mind as we continue studying the book of Acts chapter 23 and see what happened in the life of the Apostle Paul following his episode in the Jewish temple and his rescue by the Roman legion. I'm guided by the unseen hand, I'm sure is what the Apostle Paul would have said. The songwriter was exactly right. God occasionally works in ways that are miraculous to us. I don't know that there's any difference between the normal and the miraculous to God, but events that are clearly miraculous, and that does happen from time to time, but far, far, far more often, God uses what to us appear to be completely normal and natural events to work His purposes in our lives. He is always working to make the normal affairs of life produce the effects that He has planned. An unexpected storm, an irritating traffic jam, the seemingly chance meeting of some person, and some danger has been averted, some change of direction has been effected in our lives, and usually completely unknown to us. But omnipotence has His agents everywhere. And so returning now to Acts chapter 23, we will notice in verses 11 through 15, the hand of opposition, and then in verses 16 and following, the hand of providence. Remember, after all of the turmoil in Jerusalem, we read in verse 11, "But the following night the Lord stood by him," that is Paul, "and said, 'Be of good cheer, Paul. For as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness in Rome.' And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Now there were more than 40 who formed this conspiracy. They came to the chief priests and elders and said, 'We have bound ourselves under a great oath that we will eat nothing until we have killed Paul. Now you, therefore, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow, as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him, but we are ready to kill him before he comes near.'" Wow. Wow. What an episode of the life of the Apostle Paul. And yet he did not die on this occasion. Why not? Well, we're going to get into that. Thank you for joining us on this Sunday, May 8th, and thank you for the financial support that makes this ministry and its continuation possible. Well, first of all, the hand of opposition. And in that, we see once again the wickedness of false religion and the extent to which falsehood will go to oppose truth. We shouldn't be surprised when we see some pretty evil things coming out of religion. All religion is flawed. Well, should I put it this way? Let me back up and say, all practitioners of religion are flawed, because all of us are sinners, fallen sons and daughters of Adam. And even those who are saved are not yet fully sanctified. So even God's true children at times display characteristics which are very unchristlike, and certainly those that are pursuing counterfeit religion, hypocritical religion, empty ceremonial religion without a change of heart effected by the Holy Spirit of God can be counted on to do virtually nothing but sinful thoughts, acts, deeds, and words. What else could you expect? And so who are we looking at on this occasion? Well, we are told certain of the Jews, verse 12, when it was day, some or certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves. Who are these people? Well, according to the designation of that day, they are probably the ones who are called zealots. They were the political radicals of the day. They would have been what would have been called in our day extreme nationalists, those who were extreme on the right. We have in politics today people who are extreme on the right, people who are extreme on the left, and all kinds of things in between. We have people on both ends of the spectrum that are willing to do violence in order to achieve their goals. They're willing to break the law. They're willing to injure people, in some cases even willing to kill, in order to further their cause. Like the few, two or three or however many, that have killed doctors who performed abortions. Is that a good thing to do? I hope you don't think so. We have no right to do that. We have no warrant to do that. We have no command to do that. Jesus didn't instruct his followers to go around killing those who are sinning, even those who are sinning in a very alarming way, a very destructive way. Now, that doesn't mean that we approve of what they do. It doesn't mean that we won't do what we can politically to oppose them and stop them. But folks, it's not in our hands to engage in violence in order to stop even violence. Unless we're talking about someone who is attacking you. We do have the right of self-defense. But when a sniper sets up business and shoots an abortion doctor, that's not acting in self-defense. Well, I'm coming to the defense of the unborn. There are proper and improper ways to do that. And if you don't understand the difference, then you are a danger to society. But again, that's fallen nature. But that isn't only a problem on the right. I'm simply saying things like this so that those of you who are on the right will not disagree with me when I say that there are evil people who are willing to work violence on both sides of the political spectrum. And we certainly have some on the left who are willing to do exactly the same and have done exactly the same. So here we go, back and forth. Almost every time that there is some shooting, the press seems to rush to the judgment that this was caused by some right-wing radical, when in many cases it turns out that the person was not a right-wing radical at all. My mind goes all the way back to the assassination of John F. Kennedy by Lee Harvey Oswald, who, after it first happened, was immediately labeled in the press a white right-wing extremist, some kind of a John Bircher type or something like that, until it was discovered that he was actually a communist who had traveled to Russia, who had traveled to Cuba, who was a follower of Marxism. And then suddenly his political identity became unimportant to those who were not interested in exposing any violence on the left, but only what they assumed to be violence on the right. Well, back and forth it goes, back and forth it goes in our day. And sometimes those on the right use the extremism on the left to justify their extremism, and it goes right back the other way. Those on the left use the extremism on the right to justify their extremism. And frankly, None of this is justifiable from a biblical standpoint. But I'm saying all that to say things really haven't changed, and you have the same thing in Paul's day. Now, when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. These zealots, more than 40 in number, now they appealed to, we read in verse 14, the chief priests and elders, right? They came to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a great oath." So there's no question that these people, the chief priests and elders, are the religious leaders of that day. The Jews that banded themselves together with the plot and the pledge, the vow, to kill Paul, were not religious leaders as such, but they apparently received endorsement and help and sanction from the religious leaders. Wow. The chief priests and elders. Chief priests would refer to Ananias and the leading members of the Sanhedrin closest to the high priest. The elders are the leaders of Israel, members of the Sanhedrin, and perhaps some others as well. They're not broken down here into their own religious parties, such as Pharisees and Sadducees. Actually, the majority of the religious leaders in Paul's day were Sadducees, but some were Pharisees, but the majority were Sadducees. But that's another point for another day. But it is, I think, interesting to note some of the parallels. The Sadducees were in the minority, and yet they held the political power. How did that happen? Well, they did it by being clever, and by ingratiating themselves to Rome. And so they were given the appointments that made it possible for them to be the leading political party in Israel, even though they were not in the majority among Jewish people. You see any parallel to that in our day? I'll just leave it at that and we'll go on. We won't continue to explore that any farther. But what I want you to see is the sinfulness, the wickedness of organized religion. They didn't really have a case against Paul, except they hated him, and they wanted to be rid of him. That's really what it boiled down to. They couldn't indict him and try him on the evidence, but that didn't make any difference to them. They would have loved to have dealt with him that way, legally, if they could, but if not, they're going to deal with him illegally. Again, just like the guy who shoots the abortion doctor. If the law won't do what is right, then I'll take the law into my own hands. Wrong. That's not pleasing to the Lord. You have every right, yes, we would even say every responsibility, to do everything you can to affect, to influence government, to influence the law, to make it line up with what is right and just and righteous, so that the law is acting properly. But when it doesn't, and frankly, folks, haven't you figured this out yet, that in this fallen, sinful world, so many of the times, the courts, so many of the times, law does not act according to truth and righteousness. It is being carried out by people who are fallen sinners, just like all of us are. And therefore, there's all kinds of injustices. Frankly, there are many of them, aren't there? And we have to bow to the sovereignty of God. You have to come to terms with the fact that God could stop any of this, and will, when it pleases him, and he hasn't yet, and therefore it pleases him to allow this for purposes that we may not understand. I think it would be probably better to make that stronger. Purposes that we do not understand and cannot understand, and it's not our place to demand to understand. That is a hard thing for many of God's people to come to terms with. that God allows the political rulers that we are so grieved about. That God allows the political situations that we many times are so grieved about. But it is my faith, it is my study of scriptures that has brought me to these opinions and convictions that are so contrary to what's going on in the government of my country today. How can God be, can I use this word, pleased with this? Well, it's beyond our full understanding, isn't it? God's ways are above our ways. In one sense, it is perfectly accurate to say God is not pleased with this. Because God is not pleased with sin, and he's certainly not the author of sin, and yet, in his sovereign purposes, he uses evil to accomplish ultimate good. You say, why does he do that? I don't know. I mean, I've got some ideas, but I really don't know. But come on, that's what the Bible teaches over and over. There would have been no propitiatory atonement upon the cross if that were not so. Who would have put Christ to death except evil sinners acting in the place of corrupt government officials and religious leaders to bring about that which is totally evil, to put an innocent man to death? But if that were not permitted, if that were not allowed, there would be no sacrifice for sin. God obviously allowed these evil people to do what their hearts desired to do. He didn't stop them. He could have. He didn't stop them. What does the songwriter say about Christ on the cross? He could have called 10,000 angels to destroy the world and set him free. Of course he could have. And he could have given the chief priests and the religious leaders, he could have stopped them. He could have wiped them out. He could have sent some disease to them, some infection to them that would have rendered them incapable of doing what they did, could have wiped them out, could have killed them. He could have sent a lightning bolt and struck Pilate. I mean, he could have stopped that. But, of course, if he did, then where would be the sacrifice for your sins and mine? He didn't stop it because, frankly, listen to me, it served his divine purposes. Well, you say, I can see it in that case, but I can't see it in so many other cases. No, we can't. Usually we can't. But it's just as true when we can't see it as when we can. In the case of the cross, we can see it. It makes sense. All right, I'll concede that one, but I'm not willing to concede another one. Well, change your mind. You need to be willing to concede another one because that's the way God operates, and you'll never understand him, and you're not expected to understand him, but you can cling to what you know about him. God is holy. God is loving. God is righteous. God is good. God is just. God is omnipotent. He's all-powerful. And God is working out his purposes unerringly, and he is using the evil of men to carry out his purposes in many cases, including all of the evil that goes on in politics and all of the evil that goes on in religion. And we see in this account before us how sinful desires often make unnatural alliances against the common enemies of truth. Don't we see that? We see that here. We saw that at the cross of Christ, where the sinful religious leaders made alliance with the, in this case, the sinful and weak political establishment in order to carry out their purposes. Now, what appreciation did the Jewish religious leaders have for Rome? They hated Rome. They despised Rome. Their purpose was to overthrow Rome and gain freedom. And yet they were willing to become accomplices of Rome. They were willing to become partners with Rome to accomplish their hatred of Jesus Christ. And on it goes. We see that in our own nation today so many times. We've seen prominent American politicians, even presidents, who claimed to be Christians and Baptists, and yet we find them lining themselves up with organizations in America that are opposed to things Christian, actually trying in some cases to hinder the exercise and free expression of religion, and particularly Christianity in our day. How can that happen? How can radical left groups like the ACLU and People for the American Way align themselves with presidents who claim to be Christians and even Baptists, which is normally a more conservative branch of Christianity? Well, because evil designs make unnatural alliances against common enemies. And truth always ends up getting slaughtered in the process. So, it's that kind of people who were opposing Paul. The foot soldiers on the ground, the zealots, the right-wingers, the extremists, the radicals, in concert with the religious leaders who are also determined to get rid of Paul. They wouldn't have soiled their own hands personally to kill him, but they were certainly happy to make alliance with some people who would. So when was all of this going to happen? Well, the next day. We read in verse 12, and when it was day, some of the Jews banded together after this night when Jesus had appeared to Paul and assured him that he would be able to go to Rome and to represent Christ there. Remember that? The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you also must bear witness at Rome." Why did Jesus come to Paul at this time to tell him that? Well, because he knew what was coming next, and he knew that Paul would realize that his life was in danger, and he needed to know, or at least the Lord wanted him to know, that his life was not going to end by the side of the road at the hands of these evil murderers. He was going to live to get to Rome. So now he had that assurance from Jesus. And then we read, when it was day, the very next day, some of the Jews banded together. The plot must have been hatched the night before. The plot must have been hatched the very night that Jesus appeared to Paul. The Lord comes to Paul, and I suppose we could say Satan comes to the Jews. The Lord assures Paul of his continued living, and the Jews plot Paul's death. The Lord assures Paul that he will minister in Rome, and the Jews take an oath that they will neither eat nor drink. They're going to eat nothing until Paul is dead. Now, whose will is going to prevail? I've often wondered about these men who swore that they would not eat anything until they killed Paul. I wonder if any of them died of starvation. That's what it says. When it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Well, they didn't kill Paul, not then or ever. They never did. Did they die of thirst? Did they die of starvation? No, not likely. You know they didn't. They broke their vow. But there is this plan that was formalized with a band of zealots and the leaders of the Sanhedrin during the day following Paul's hearing before the Sanhedrin. And this vow, they must have planned that they were going to kill him within 24 hours. "May I be eternally damned if I eat or drink before I kill Paul," is literally what they're saying here. "Or may I be killed if I eat or drink before I have killed Paul." Well, they weren't planning for this to take a long time. They were obviously planning to kill him over the course of the next few hours. or they wouldn't have made a vow this way. They certainly weren't planning to go on a several-day fast, a week-long fast, a month-long fast. They were planning to withhold food from themselves for just a few hours to remind them of the seriousness of their plan and to carry it through and to do away with Paul. But, of course, they weren't able to fulfill their vow, which is why the Bible tells us to treat vows very cautiously and very seriously. Some of us probably ought to make a vow neither to eat nor drink until we lose a few pounds, for example. And some of you probably could make a vow neither to eat nor drink until you get something right with God or make something right with another person, or at least do everything you can to attempt to do so. That wouldn't be a bad idea at all. But we need to be careful about the kinds of vows we make before the Lord. This is a very foolish one. Here's what the Talmud said, the Jewish Talmud. He that made a vow not to eat anything, woe to him if he eat, and woe to him if he do not eat. If he eat, he sins against his vow, and if he do not eat, he sins against his life. What must such a man do in this case? Let him go to the wise men, and they will loose his vow. Isn't that interesting? The Talmud says something similar to what the Bible tells us about the inadvisability of making vows. You better think it through very carefully before you make one. But they make this vow, and they decide between themselves and the religious leaders that they are going to request that the Roman commander bring Paul down so that they can ask him a few more questions. Their feigned purpose is to clarify some issue of the law, but of course that's not their real purpose at all. And thus we see how religion is disgracing itself with lies and murderous plots spawned no doubt by Satan, the father of lies. And what they really plan to do is to set an ambush. That's what they're going to do. You therefore, verse 15, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow, as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him, but we are ready to kill him before he comes near. Their plan was to ambush him on the way to this council meeting. That's what they were planning to do. They thought that they could get away with it. With 40 of them, that would be certainly more than probably the one or two, or at the most three or four soldiers who would be escorting him to the trial, and they would overcome them, and were willing, I'm sure, some of them, to even give up their own life in the battle that would no doubt ensue, as the soldiers did their best to defend their prisoner, but they were confident that with 40 of them, they could overcome the Roman guard, and they could kill Paul, and then they would be satisfied. But it didn't happen that way. The hand of opposition is able to accomplish nothing against the child of God unless God wills it. That's the point. Do you understand that? Do you believe that? As a child of God, I am invincible in this world until God desires to take me home. And then why would I want to stay? Until tomorrow, Greg Barkman saying good day. May God give you His eternal peace.